Jihad versus Harem. The eighth talk in a series on the narrative portions of Joshua was presented by David Crabtree on September 24, 2006 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2006. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
I'm going to do something atypical today. I hope it proves to be beneficial. Last week, in talking about Joshua chapter 10, I made the comment that there are some similarities between the holy war that God asked the Israelites to conduct against the Canaanites in the Promised Land and jihad, and yet that I think that there are fundamental differences between the two things. And there were about five people that asked for us to have time to talk more about that. So I went down to the library and got some books at a library and read them over the course of the week. And so now I have a sophomoric knowledge of Islam, which means I know just enough to be dangerous. But so it was just kind of a crash course. I really don't know much about Islam, but I am kind of interested in this topic. So I'm going to use my time to launch it. And then I'm hoping to leave plenty of time for discussion. I'm sure that there are people here who know things that I don't know at all about Islam and jihad. So this is different than what is typically done here, and I don't want to, and I want this to be atypical, because this is very different from teaching from the Bible. There's a sense in which I feel a lot more comfortable teaching the Bible, because I see my job in teaching the Bible is just kind of leading you through a passage. But what is authoritative is what's in the passage itself, not what I say. But there's something there of substance, whether I do a good job on leading you through it or not. Here, it's just, I'm just giving you information, and it's information on something that about which I am not authoritative at all. So this is very different, and you ought to see it as being different from what is typically done here. Let me see if I can frame the issue for you. God, when he led the Israelites into Canaan, he asked them, commanded them to kill all of the people, men, women, and children, kill the livestock, and the plunder that they took from the cities was to be turned over to God. They were not to keep it themselves. So and we've talked about this before, it is a kind of strange and in some ways seems out of character with the God of the Bible to command his people to do that. But he did. The modern Islamic fundamentalists are claiming that the revelations that were given to Muhammad are the latest, and they are the most authoritative revelations that God has given, that Islam is the definitive religion, the culmination of all that God was doing, and that God has given the Muslims a command to spread Islam throughout the world, and has given them an injunction to carry out a jihad against those who would oppose that movement. So there are some similarities between what what they are claiming with respect to jihad and what God commanded the Israelites going into the Promised Land. And it raises in my mind a couple of questions. One is, if we find the jihad abhorrent, then why isn't what God commanded the Israelites abhorrent? That's the first question. The second question is, if we don't find what God did in the Old Testament abhorrent, is it out of question that God would raise up others who would do a similar service on his behalf? Is it possible that the jihad is God ordained and God authorized? So what I'd like to do is just look briefly at what the jihad is, and then briefly at what the rules regarding what the Israelites are supposed to do in Canaan are. It's called harem. So I'll compare jihad with harem, harem being what the Israelites carried out in Palestine. Okay, so what is jihad? The first, I found it very interesting. I did not know this at all, but there are debates that are conducted with respect to how to understand the teachings of the Quran that have their parallels in the Christian community with respect to how to understand the Bible. But there are some differences. As you can expect, there are a wide variety of views within Islam as to how to understand any of the teachings of Islam, but in particular, how to understand what the jihad is. So it's a question of who do you listen to. Muslims accept the Quran as being the authoritative word of God. It was dictated to Muhammad starting in 610 and over a period of years. And as they understand it, Muhammad wrote it down word for word, exactly what God told him to write down. So they ascribe to what we would call a dictation theory of inspiration. They accept the authority of the Old Testament and the New Testament as well. They think all of those were God-inspired, and that God over time has slowly made clearer and clearer what he is about and what his purposes are. However, they would say that the Quran takes precedence over both the Old Testament and the New Testament. And they do this by the principle of abrogation, is what they call it. Abrogation is when there are two parts of inspired truth that are in conflict, then one abrogates the other. And generally speaking, that which is most recent abrogates that which is most ancient. So if there's a conflict between the Old Testament and the New Testament, what it says in the New Testament abrogates what was in the Old Testament. If there's a conflict between the Quran and anything in the Old Testament or the New Testament, then the Quran abrogates both what was written in the New Testament and the Old Testament. So the new is preferred to the old. Now, there are other texts that have come to be. They were written after the Quran was written. They were written by followers. There's a first generation and a second generation. The first generation texts were written by lieutenants of Muhammad, and then the second generation are written by people who are further afield and a little bit later. And this collection of writings is called the Hadith, so it's H with a dot under it, A-D-I-T-H. And they are considered to be authoritative, much like Catholics would say that the Apocrypha is authoritative. It doesn't hold the same status as the Quran, but it is an aid to understanding the Quran. Now, that makes things difficult That makes things difficult because they have this concept that that which is newer is to be preferred over the old with respect to these authoritative writings. So the hadith is newer. But the Quran is considered to be more authoritative. So they look at the different sections of the hadith and they give those varying degrees of authority, depending on which scholar it is. And sometimes they will allow the hadith to abrogate what's written in the Quran, or at least explain what's written in the Quran, and other times they will not grant it that kind of authority. I should point out this abrogation works within the Quran itself as well. The Quran was written over a number of years. And if there are conflicts within the Quran, that which was written most recently abrogates that which was written before it within the Quran. Okay, because they accept a dictation theory of inspiration, the Quran is not to be translated. People are supposed to learn Arabic so they can read God's words rather than God's words translated. And I will point out that it's interesting that because it is what God dictated, they tend to not pay as much attention to context. As they see it, these writings rise above context, and therefore the context in which these things were written is not as relevant as certainly we here would see the writings of the Bible. And I find that interesting. Okay, so there are lots of understandings of the Quran. So if you were to ask a Muslim what is jihad, or if you were to ask Muslims, you would get a number of different answers. But the word jihad means striving. And in most of the context, it's striving in a military sense. There are some modern interpreters who have argued that this striving is purely a spiritual striving, that it's not to be understood as a military kind of striving whatsoever. But that is a modern interpretation and relatively rare. The vast majority would say that this striving is with respect to warfare. So I found this definition of jihad that seems to encapsulate the dominant perspective. It is warfare authorized by a legitimate representative of the Muslim community for the sake of an issue that is universally or nearly universally acknowledged to be of critical importance for the entire community against an admitted enemy of Islam. Jihad is frequently mentioned in the Quran and in the Hadith, and possibly even more commonly in the Hadith, especially in the later writings of the Hadith. And that seems to be partly explained by the fact that Islam was born in bloodshed, that it became militaristic from very early on, and then continued to be militaristic for the first several centuries of its existence. In fact, in the last 10 years of Muhammad's life, he was in constant warfare. In those last 10 years, he waged 27 campaigns and sent out troops on another 59 campaigns. So it was constant warfare against a variety of foes. Let me give you a 10-minute version of the early history of Islam, and I think that helps to understand the militaristic nature of the religion. Muhammad, the prophet of Islam, was born in 570. He was raised, his mother died when he was young. He was raised by his grandfather. And then when his grandfather died, he was raised by his uncle. His uncle was the leader of the dominant tribe of the area where he lived, which was the city of Mecca in what is now Saudi Arabia. His uncle took him under his wing, and for a number of years, Muhammad had his first revelations when in 610. Muhammad was influenced by a form of asceticism that had developed in that part of Arabia. The dominant religion was paganism, polytheistic paganism. But paganism was on the wane and was kind of falling out of favor. What was coming in was Christianity and Judaism. And some of the Arabs in the area took bits and pieces from Christianity and Judaism and developed a kind of ascetic religion that emphasized spiritual practices and disciplines. And apparently Muhammad was heavily influenced by those and began going out into the mountains and spending time in a cave just by himself. And it was during one of these outings that he received his first revelation from God. And God came to him and said, "Muhammad, recite." And Muhammad says, "Recite what?" And there's this dialogue that goes between them. But eventually, God tells him to write down what God is going to say to him. And so the Quran, the word Quran means recitation. It's that which Muhammad heard from God and recited in written form so that everybody could read it. So these revelations from God and these writings that came out of this are similar in spirit to this movement that was afoot in Arabia otherwise, and it's that combination of Judaism and Christianity. And Muhammad began to preach this new religion in the name of the God Allah, who is said to be the same God as the God of the Bible. He preaches this in Mecca and gains a certain number of adherents, largely among the outcasts of the community. Apparently, Arabic society was quite hierarchical, quite stratified socially. And those who were on the lower rungs were at a great disadvantage with respect to just getting along in life and making a living. And it was those in the lower rungs that responded most readily to what Muhammad had to say, because what he was preaching was an egalitarian kind of religion. It leveled those social differences. At first, his uncle was the leader of the main tribe when he first started preaching Islam, and therefore his uncle looked kindly upon Muhammad and allowed him to propagate this new religion. But then he died, and someone else became the tribal leader, and friction developed between Muhammad and this new tribal leader. Apparently, this new tribal leader saw Muhammad as a threat. And as a result, the Muslims in Mecca began to be persecuted. So Muhammad and his followers fled Mecca. They went to an oasis. One source says it's 150 miles. The other says it's 275 miles. That's quite a difference. But it's someplace to the north. They fled to this other area, a large oasis where there were a number of tribes that settled in the area of this oasis. And that flight is called the Hijra. There at the location of this oasis where he and his followers settled, they began to convert many of the tribes, and a lot of people responded to his message. They converted to Islam, and slowly he developed a community there, which developed a governmental form. And as a result, Muhammad became the political leader, the spiritual leader, and the military leader of this community. A couple of the tribes that were in this oasis were Jewish tribes. He tried to convert them and win them over to this, to Islam. And in order to do so, he taught that all Muslims should pray facing Jerusalem. He made the holy day of Islam the Sabbath. But the Jews did not convert. They were not interested in Islam. So Muhammad and his followers took them militarily. And they changed the direction that you pray from Jerusalem to Mecca, and they changed the holy day from the Sabbath to Friday. So he took control of this entire oasis and all the tribes that were living there and created a significant military force out of that. In order to create an economy that would support all of these people, Muhammad did what was not uncommon in Arabic culture. A lot of communities did the same thing. They would raid caravans that were transporting goods from one place to another. Most of those caravans, or a large number of those caravans, were being operated by merchants who lived in Mecca. So as these caravans would go north, Muhammad and his followers would raid them, take the goods, and in so doing, they were harming the economy of Mecca, his hometown. So the people of Mecca put together an army and came and attacked Muhammad the area of this oasis, which later, by the way, becomes known as Medina. They besieged Medina, and Muhammad and his followers were able to withstand the siege, and eventually they reached a peace agreement with the people of Mecca, but were not defeated. In this peace agreement, then, Muhammad gained the rights of his followers to go to Mecca on a pilgrimage. Muhammad saw Mecca as the holy place of Islam. And slowly, Muhammad began to make some inroads into Meccan society as a result of this kind of contact that developed. And he was able then in 630 to launch an attack against Mecca with some complicity on the part of some of the citizens of Mecca. He took control of Mecca, and they smashed all of the idols in the Kaaba. In Mecca, there was this thing called the Kaaba, and it had become a place of pilgrimage for polytheistic pagans because they put one of each idol, an idol to every god, in this Kaaba, in this box. So when Muhammad came back and conquered Mecca, he destroyed all of those idols, and the Kaaba then became the center point of Islam. It became a symbol of Allah. Then 2 years after he took Mecca, Muhammad died. So now Islam controls Mecca and Medina. It has converted a number of the Arabic tribes in between have converted to Islam, so it's a fairly significant number of people. Well, up to now, a mainstay of the economies of those people has been raiding each other, stealing from each other. Islam forbids Muslims to steal from other Muslims. So Islam starts to turn outward. Islam becomes very aggressive in going into non-Muslim areas, conquering those areas, and using that plunder as a source of keeping their economic system going. So Islam becomes very aggressive, and it spreads itself militarily into Iran, into Syria, and into Egypt. And all that happens in a very short period of time. Then later, it spreads into Central Asia, into India, and into North Africa. In all of these cases, it does so militarily. One of the books that I read pointed out that there is no place where Islam has become dominant that did not happen without military conquest. It's an interesting observation. One of the authors says, "It was certainly good policy to turn the recently subdued tribes of the wilderness towards an external aim in which they might at once satisfy their lust for booty on a grand scale, maintain their warlike feeling, and strengthen themselves in their attachment to the new faith." So with this background, it's probably not surprising that both the Quran and the Hadith would be full of references to military action, full of references to jihad, and full of references to martyrdom. Here are just three quotes from the Quran. One says that it is enjoined on all Muslims to fight all men until they say there is no God but Allah. And that's in a military context. Another one, the gates of paradise are under the shadow of the swords. And another one, a morning or an evening expedition in God's path is better than the world and what it contains. And for one of you to remain in the line of battle is better than his prayers for 60 years. Martyrdom is also a common theme. And it points out in the Quran that there are rewards that await one who dies fighting for Allah. There are two kinds of rewards. The one is, that is explicitly stated, one is the sexual rewards, and you've probably heard about those, the 72 virgins that are waiting for one who is a martyr. I'll point out that that particular reward is not in the Quran, that's in the Hadith, and it's a relatively late writing in the Hadith. But such references are also... sexual references are in the Quran as well as in the Hadith, as well as rewards that await one who dies fighting for Allah. Another reward is a privileged status in heaven, that if one dies a martyr, they have the privilege of being an intercessor on the Day of Judgment. And apparently an intercessor is in a position to be able to argue on behalf of anyone who is a Muslim that they ought to be rewarded in heaven. In one context, it says that one who dies a martyr can speak on behalf of 70 of his kinsmen. A text that I read says, "Thus the concept developed differently in Islam than it did in either Judaism or Christianity. Martyrdom in Islam has a much more active sense. The prospective martyr is called to seek out situations in which martyrdom might be achieved." So it's not if martyrdom comes to you, then you will be rewarded, but it's the kind of thing that you ought to seek out in order to gain those rewards. Okay, let me just make a few comments about the features of Islam just on the basis of my crash study of Islam over the week. The first is that Islam is more political and more cultural than Christianity. Now, what do I mean by that? That's a good question. This is a difficult point to argue. What do I mean that it's more political or cultural? But it seems to be have goals and aims that are more specifically political and cultural than does either Christianity or Judaism. Islam historically has been spread by conquest, so it tends to be very militaristic. and it wants to restore its former dominion that it had. What would it be? 1,000 years ago? It wants to restore its dominion to all of those areas that at one time were part of Islam. And it thinks in terms of doing that militaristically. Islam is very apocalyptic. It wants the end to come. And it is understood that the end will come when Islam controls the whole world. The phenomenon here kind of reminds me of the Great Commission in Christianity, that there's that understanding that once the gospel is taught in all areas of the world, that then the end can come. And so there's the movement to go out and make sure that that happens as quickly as possible to bring the end. Well, Islam's jihad is a similar kind of thing. Let's go conquer the world as quickly as we can so that the end will come. And I will point out that these hopes of conquering the world had become dormant in Islamic thinking until Afghanistan. Well, even before that, in Iran, when Ayatollah Khomeini took control there, and then in Afghanistan, when the Muslims there defeated the Soviet Union, drove them out, those both gave Islam a great deal of hope that this task that had been given to Islam could be done with God's help. And they saw both of those as indications of God's help that was being provided. Some of the Islamic fundamentalists have said that the thing that stood in the way of Islam coming to dominate the entire world was the two superpowers, the Soviet Union and the United States. And in Afghanistan, Islam defeated the most powerful of those two powers. So now it's just mopping up the easy one, which is the United States. And their thinking behind that is the United States is ultimately soft. The Soviet Union was not soft. The Soviet Union had proved itself, particularly in World War II. The Soviet Union proved that it has staying power, that it is tenacious in a military conflict. The United States has never demonstrated that. In fact, it has shown just the opposite. And that's the way they assess things. The outcome of Vietnam is something that they would look to that gives them great encouragement. But they would look to other things like what happened in Mogadishu, what happened in Lebanon. All of those are examples of America's propensity to cut and run as soon as things get difficult. The third thing that I would observe about the features of Islam is that modern-day Islam is angry and it's bitter. That the Muslim countries have been dominated by Western powers for the last 150 years, and they have built up a great deal of bitterness over that. And they think that the rest of the world is conspiring to get rid of Islam. They're really given to conspiracy theories that everybody is out to just crush Islam. And so what they are doing is defensive in their minds. Okay. What is harem then? What was enjoined upon the people of Israel when they went into Canaan? The word harem means devoted to destruction. And the Israelites were told to destroy all of the Canaanites and all of their possessions, except they were to leave the cities, they were to leave the vineyards, they were to leave the fruit trees. Those were to be given over to the Israelites. But all of the wealth, all of the cultural artifacts were to be given over to God. I'll point out that in practice, and I'm not sure why this is the case, the full rules of harem were only carried out on a few cities. In other cities, those were modified. In some, as we noticed last week in Joshua 10, in some cities, the Israelites were allowed to keep that which they plundered. And exactly why that's the case, I do not know. The harem was apparently a judgment upon the people of Canaan. God had told Abraham that the iniquity of the Canaanites was not yet full when Abraham was in the land. And when the Israelites came back to claim the land, apparently that was then God's judgment on the Canaanites for their iniquity. Their iniquity at that point was full. So the harem was prescribed against those who were guilty. That is, they had been rebellious against God to an extent that God decided to punish them, to have a judgment placed on them. Now, I say that with a little bit of hesitation because the harem was carried out against men, women, and children. So we're talking about even infants who are put to death. Are they guilty? Well, I think there's a sense in which probably they are not guilty. But nevertheless, there's a kind of corporate guilt that falls upon them. The third thing that's interesting about harem is it's carried out by God's chosen people. It wasn't just anybody who carried this out. It was God's people. They were acting as conscious servants of God. They were carrying out God's will, and they knew that they were carrying out God's will. They were doing it in obedience to God. That's in contrast to other peoples who carried out God's judgment, but were not doing it in obedience to God and therefore were punished for doing so. It points out in Genesis that the Israelites were going to be taken into slavery for a number of years, but that later God was going to punish the Egyptians for doing that. Later on, God says that the Chaldeans are going to come in. They are going to invade Judah, and that's going to be as punishment for the sins of Judah. But God says, I'm going to punish them for doing so. So those are instances in which peoples were used as agents of God's punishment, but they did not act out of obedience to God, and as a result, God later punished them for doing that very thing. In this case, the Israelites were acting as agents of the punishment of God, but doing so out of obedience, and therefore were not punished for carrying that out. So as far as I can think of, the harem that was carried out in Palestine was a unique kind of event carried out by God's chosen people, where they were the instruments of God's punishment and acting in obedience in doing so. The harem was a unique and focused event. It was not extended to other wars that Israel engaged in. And God was, I think, in doing so, and this is something we could talk about more, God seems to have been creating a picture in history, something that he has done before, seems to have done quite a bit of in the Old Testament, creating a picture of a greater and more consequential judgment yet to come. And I think the harem is a picture in history of a judgment that is yet to come, that will be swift and will be decisive. And the fifth thing I'll point out with respect to harem is, as I understand it, it was to be conducted in a way that was not cruel. And it sounds strange that you could have people commanded to go in and kill everyone, man, woman, and child, but it not be cruel. But I think that that's possible. There isn't torture involved here. They're just to go in and kill those who have been rebellious against God. there was an intimidation that was involved in Hiram. That is, God had said that he was going to spread dread and fear in the hearts of the Canaanites before the Israelites even came. But the source of that fear and dread was primarily from the wondrous things that God had done as he led the people out of Egypt. So what's scaring the people of Canaan are those actions which God has taken, the parting of the Red Sea, the bringing of the manna, and those kinds of things. That's what they've heard, and that is what is intimidating them, because they see God on the side of the Israelites. As opposed to another kind of intimidation, which is through whatever torture, terrorist kinds of activities. Okay. It is difficult for me to put my finger on exactly what is different between jihad and Hiram and the spirit of the Israelites and the spirit of the fundamentalist Muslims. But it strikes me that there is a sense in which Islam is very this worldly. They believe in heaven, they believe in an afterlife, but there's something about the whole spirit of it that's very this worldly. I don't know exactly how to describe that, but I would say that it's akin to the Pharisees. The Pharisees also believed in the spiritual realm and were doing things in the name of the spiritual realm. But there is nevertheless something very this worldly about Phariseeism. And I think similarly, Islam is very this worldly. The Hiram is difficult to understand and explain, I think. But I think it is not totally out of character with the God of the Bible. There is something about it that is measured and principled. The jihad, at least as we see it talked about, as we see it practiced, it is vengeful, it is bitter, it is power-grabbing, and it is bullying. So I think that the spirit behind it is very, very different. And it seems to me that jihad is that which is commanded by something that cannot be the God of the New Testament and the Old Testament. Okay, I would welcome any comments or questions that you might have to make.
Can you explain to us, I could never quite understand, I understand the whole concept of jihad, but I don't understand why they feel so justified in killing other Muslims in terms of the Shiites and the Sunnis.
Right. That's a good question. I don't know the answer to that. There are some proponents of jihad who their understanding of the Quran and the Hadith justifies carrying out a jihad against other Muslims. Historically, there have been Muslim countries that have called a jihad against other Muslim countries. But how exactly they justify that, I do not know. My suspicion is that it's on the basis of something like they are heretics and therefore are not real Muslims. But I don't know that for sure.
Good morning.
Morning.
I'm new here, and I really enjoyed what you just had to say. Yeah. One of the scriptures that came to my mind was this battle of spiritual war and physical war. And if this has any bearing on what you're saying, I'd like to just read about three scriptures here. I came to my mind in 2 Corinthians 10. Beginning with verse 3. For though we walk in the flesh, we do not war according to the flesh. For the weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but mighty in God for pulling down strongholds, casting down arguments and every high thing that exalts itself against the knowledge of God, bringing every thought into captivity to the obedience of Christ, and being ready to punish all disobedience when your obedience is fulfilled.
It seems like a lot of what you've said is that both in the Muslims' approach to their own the Quran or this other book is very they sort of set it up so that they justify their own view.
Well, it certainly allows for that.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yes, it allows for that. Both in their approach to their scriptures plus their approach to how they think about killing people.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. You didn't address this issue, but I wonder if there is a perspective that the Quran has about human nature and the tendency of fallen human nature to justify itself.
Yeah, that's a very good question. And like I said last week, I have not read all of the Quran. I would like to, but I haven't. So here's where I'm ignorant. But to the extent that I have read the Quran, it is right at that point that it is different, at least just the section that I have read, is different in spirit from what you see in the Bible. But what I find so compelling about the Bible is its ability to penetrate right to my soul and kind of open it up and give me a glimpse of what's happening deep down there. From what I've read in the Quran, you don't have any similar kind of phenomenon taking place. It doesn't encourage that kind of introspection of what's happening right at the core of my being. It's much more Pharisaical in that sense. Wait, why don't you wait just a second?
It seems, well, the idea of a martyr being rewarded with 72 virgins,
mm-hmm.
that seems very worldly to me. That
seems absolutely.
As opposed to the picture you have in the New Testament about a picture of eternity is this sinlessness, the value of righteousness, which is very, very different.
Right.
It doesn't seem to me that there's anything righteous about being set with 72 virgins in heaven.
Right. And that's what I mean, is in that it's kind of this worldly to the extent that the reward is just a worldly reward blown large as opposed to a spiritual, something that's truly spiritual, a transformation.
There are some tantalizing glimpses in the Old Testament of God as the God of the other nations as well as being the God of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
The passage that you mentioned, the iniquity of the Canaanites was not yet full. God was paying attention to them. He was their God. Same thing with the Ninevites.
Yes.
God had compassion. God did not bring judgment. Instead, he brought warning and a call to repent,
mm-hmm.
and they responded. And mm-hmm. I think my earlier Christian teaching sort of let me be blind to the reality that God is God everywhere, to all people and all times, and he has the right of the creator and ruler of the universe to judge what he has made.
Mm-hmm.
And That has cleared up a whole bunch of this stuff for me.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I think related to that, this isn't exactly what you're talking about, but the sovereignty of God in writing the story. In a sense, even though Allah is not God, not the God of the Bible, hasn't God raised up Islam as part of his story?
Absolutely. As I was looking at this stuff, I was reminded of what, let's see if I can find it, of what Abraham said with respect to Ishmael when he was born. Am I going to be able to find this quickly? Here it is. This is in Genesis 16, verse 11. The angel of the Lord said to her further, this is to Hagar, behold, you are with child, and you shall bear a son, and you shall call his name Ishmael, because the Lord has given heed to your affliction. and he will be a wild donkey of a man. His hand will be against everyone, and everyone's hand will be against him, and he will live to the east of all his brothers. That's the descendants of Ishmael are the Arabs, and it's just amazing to me how that has been fulfilled in our time, in that it's like the Arab world has taken to the streets and is angry against everybody else in the world for everything. And as a result, there's the kind of tension that's described here. It really seems to me that in many respects, Islam is the perfect human religion. It has all of the ingredients that we as human beings respond to and kind of want in a religion. Not true. It's not grounded in truth, but it's a great religion. It's the kind of thing that people respond to. And in that sense, it's kind of the anti-religion. It's anti-Christianity, if you could.
That's funny that I just raised my hand when you were talking about how they were in the streets mad about everything. And then you just saying that makes me self-reflect, because what my first thought was, they have right to be mad about some stuff, mm-hmm. you know?
Yes.
And maybe that's my own
yes.
desire for justice. And I think in exposing the fundamental parts of Islam, I mean, I don't think we ever hesitate to expose the fundamental parts of Christianity that have done quite a bit of damage equally. Mm-hmm. But I guess I'm curious how we, you know, distinguish. That's a way bigger question, but, you know, coming against, I think, this church and sitting with a Muslim, we might agree about behavior that is, I don't know, is infidelism a word? Is that a word?
It is now.
You know, I mean, so there is some agreement about. It's very confusing, and a different historian could look at the picture of Judaism and say that it was very political
yes.
and it was very,
yes.
you know.
Yes.
I mean, it's
yes.
the kind of spirit at which we look at it. It's so subjective. Mm-hmm. It's kind of. Do I have a question?
I think it seems to me that that's the nature of the challenge of the times in which we live. We have to become more discerning and be able to tell when we see the fingerprints of God and when those fingerprints aren't God's at all. I'm confident that God is at work in the lives of individuals within the Muslim world. I'm confident there are also very decent Muslims who would decry some of the excesses that are happening, but nevertheless, that person is a rebel against God, just as there are decent people here who are rebels against God. We have to become discerning such that we can tell when something has the earmarks of God and when it isn't. And I think that's our challenge, because times are going to get more and more confusing, where it's harder and harder to tell that. And we need God to grant us the eyes to be able to have that kind of discernment. Because I think things are going to be happening under good names that are not good things, increasingly. And it's going to be harder to sort that out. And I think that's why what it says about, as you get to the end times, God says, will there still be faith? And I think the reason for that is things are going to get very confusing. It's going to require discernment to a degree that God clearly has to be providing that to us.
A couple things. One, in 1 Corinthians 13, I was thinking about this when you were talking about the martyrdom. And I'm, by the way, in verse 3, he talks about, if I deliver my body to be burned but do not have love, it profits me nothing. I mean, there's mm-hmm. this whole concept of martyrdom
yes.
is just missing
yes. Yes.
significantly
yes.
within the scriptures.
Yes.
And attitude is everything.
Right.
The other thing is that your point was just really well taken about God's measured expectations with Joshua and David, because at the end of David's time, that was it.
Right.
That was the end of, there is no more trying to take over the world, trying to kill people and slaughter people. It
right.
then becomes relational and just huge difference.
Yes.
So I think that's
yes.
a good point.
Yes.
You were talking about abrogation, was that the word?
Yes.
That seems to be an interesting and somewhat odd kind of perspective on reading things.
Yes.
Do they offer any explanation for why God is saying one thing here and saying another thing there, changing his mind, being apparently inconsistent or contradictory or anything like that? Why he would do such a thing that would be in his character, that's okay?
I didn't run across any explanations for that. But it is an interesting phenomenon because, and there's some in within the Christian tradition, there are ways that that is done as well. But it is my observation that if you have an option like that and you come across two passages that seem to be at variance one with the other, then you're done. It's really easy to say, well, I'm done. I don't have to think about these either any further. This one's wrong. This one's been abrogated. But if you have the belief that they all fit together, then it forces you to think more and more about each passage and what could be going on there, such that at some deeper level, there is no tension at all. And that's the chore that I see that we have in the Bible, is where we see those things that seem to be contradictory. There's something we don't understand about one or the other or both passages, and we need to think about it more and sort it out. They've got several, because of the way they look at their authoritative works, it's really susceptible to the kind of manipulation that Larry was talking about. You've got all kinds of ways that you can kind of play with it and pick and choose and create whatever theological perspective you want to.
Our assumption is that God is consistent,
right?
Bringing a consistent picture to us,
right.
And trying to communicate to us in a way that's meaningful,
right?
And that apparently is not part of their picture. Is that right? Or
am I? That's my understanding. And in fact, they. I remember reading about the Mongols, and one of the Mongol Khans made a decree that had bearing on him, and then he violated that decree to show that there was nothing that stood over him. He could violate even his own decrees. They have a similar perspective with respect to God, the Muslims do. That God can violate his own decrees. He is that powerful.
This issue of Joshua and all that we're talking about here is a really good example of our abrogation. A lot of Christians and a lot of people like to just throw this part out
right.
and not deal with it,
right.
not think about it,
right.
and right. yeah, and or the entire Old Testament. Logan's right.
Right. right.
So we do it too.
Oh, absolutely. There are traditions within Christianity that have done that for a long time.
Just a couple thoughts that I had. Certainly speaking with. Oversimplifying, not really looking into it too closely. In the news recently, of course, you have Pope Benedict giving a speech where, if I can understand the gist of it, he's essentially saying one of the problems that Islam has is that it has this significant violent streak in it, and it would be better if they weren't so violent. And, of course, in outrage to that comment, they firebombed some churches and murder a nun, and are still demanding his mm-hmm. apology. His apologies that he's given haven't been right. sufficient enough, and they want him to grovel or whatever. I don't know. And that gets me thinking about, and then his response is, whoa, wait a minute, that's not what I meant, and we're friends of, Islam, and we get along and all that. And it reminded me of, like, say, after 9/11 or whatever, when it became very clear that there were some Muslims that were behind, you know, the 9/11 attack in some regard, and there was it was important for politicians to come forward and say, we want to go after those kind of Muslims, but Islam is a good religion and mm-hmm. is not violent, and we don't want to give the impression that we are saying that. Mm-hmm. And I'm just wondering what your thoughts are, because it seems that clearly there is, in fact, a certain violent streak at the heart of it, and yet there seems to be this desire for people to say, whoa, we're not saying that. Mm-hmm. And you know, is there a violent streak, you know, we call the fundamentalists, but a larger group that really isn't that way and would not agree, or, you know, is the group that's the smaller group maybe the ones that are the ones preaching against violence, and maybe they actually are in fact not in line with, you know, with Islam at its core.
Right. It seems to me that Islam has been highly influenced by modernism and modern culture and modern thought. So you have people who have been heavily influenced by that, for whom the jihad and the things that the fundamentalist Muslims are doing would be abhorrent. But what is Islam itself? And that's one where, like I say, I don't know enough to really be able to say for sure. But my sense is that Islam at its heart is anti-Christianity, that it is an imitation to a large extent of Christianity and Judaism, but at the heart of it is a very man-centered kind of religion. Could there be decent Muslims? Absolutely, there could be decent Muslims, but the religion itself, I think, is tapping into all the wrong kinds of things within us as human beings. Did I answer your question?
There we go. One of the things that I've noticed in world dealings and the response that the Muslim world seems to have to any type of dishonoring or I don't even want to say defamation, that's too, any questioning of their, how right they are, or whether or not they're right or wrong, their response is absolute and total outrage mm-hmm. at any questioning mm-hmm. whatsoever of the tenets or the things that they claim to be true. Right. When you compare Christianity, that type of questioning is encouraged. It's important that people understand what is going on in the Christian faith and what God is asking of us as believers. And I think for people in the Muslim faith, they're simply not allowed to question those things. And the response, when you look at the Orthodox Muslim response, you see the house of Islam and the house of war. And we as Westerners and as believers sit inside that house of war. And non-Orthodox Muslims, I believe, are in that house of war as well. So when you see Muslims who are peace-loving and are able to coexist with other cultures and other religions, the thing that they share in common with us is that they're in the basket of people that are okay to be killed by Orthodox Muslims. Anytime you see Christian fundamentalists acting out, shooting abortion doctors and blaming the September 11th attacks on homosexuals and things like that, you can always look at it and you can, when you dig into the scriptures, you can see that these people are acting outside of what the nature of the gospel and the message that Christ brought to the world. But when you see these attacks, these guys crashing planes into buildings and all the horrors that come in the name of jihad, in the name of this temperamental, angry, unstable God named Allah, you can't write that stuff off, because when you dig into their scriptures, they're doing exactly what their scriptures tell them to do. And they're bringing their religion and their ideals to the world with bloodshed. Is that your understanding of it?
Well, like I say, I need to read more before I can could respond to that with any reliability. But that's my sense. Yes. Okay. Thank you very much.